So how was your experience with that?
Funny.
Funny? Interesting. Funny? Interesting?
Frustrating.
Frustrating. How specifically was it?
The slow pacing was just, when I was talking slow, I didn't even want to hear myself talk.
So you naturally talk pretty fast, I gather.
Not very fast, but I guess talking slow made me want to talk faster. Mm-hmm. I hope I don't talk this slow.
So there's that effect of, you know, like we did with the fingers, you know, and crossing them over. When you do something that's out of what you're normally familiar with, that might feel a little uncomfortable or weird or something like that. And there's awesome little phrase that we have in NLP, is that if you can, you can't, and if you haven't, you must. If you can, you can't, and if you haven't, you must. And what's that? That's an invitation to do, is that if you're already good at something, if you're already really good at some aspect of NLP, some kind of technique or something like that, sometimes we will invite you to take that off the table. And if it's something that you haven't learned yet or haven't practiced or don't feel comfortable with, those are the things that we invite you to do. Because that's where you're going to get your expansion. That's where you're going to get more skill. Other experiences, yeah?
Oh, other people could share, but I thought you were done. I was just wondering what we were supposed to get out of it, because every other exercise I felt like I get it, and on this one, I mean, it was easy to talk faster, I guess more enthusiastic talking faster, and slow is not fun, but I don't really know.
So that's how you experienced it, when you were talking faster you felt more enthusiastic, yeah. And then when you talked slower it was not
boring.
Fun, boring?
Yeah, and kind of left out of the conversation, mm-hmm. when everybody else is talking, and you just talk slow, maybe a little left out of it.
So these are important things to notice as far as, you know, one, if you alter your rate of speech, your tone, tempo, or volume kind of a thing, how does it affect your internal experience? You know, does it shift your state or something like that? But it also may give you clues about how another person might be experiencing something, depending on their rate of speech.
Well, I really liked what our conversation we were discussing, but when I was talking fast, all I wanted to do was disagree and pick a fight, you know? And then when I was talking slow, I couldn't enjoy the conversation, mm-hmm. and I was almost putting myself to sleep talking mm-hmm. slow. And I was actually interested in the conversation, so then I resorted to like disagreeing just so I would kind of stay awake.
Yeah. So this is the auditory equivalent of what we were doing when we were mismatching physiologically, right? If you're mismatching tone, tempo, and volume, the theory is it would tend to lessen rapport. And when you match tone, tempo, and volume, it would tend to increase rapport. And it kind of makes sense on one level, you know, it's like just to make it easier to converse if you're at the same rate. It's a little bit like, you know, trying to walk with somebody, and if they're walking really fast and you're walking really slow and you're trying to have a conversation, that's difficult to do. But if you're walking side by side at the same pace, it's just easier. It's easier to have a conversation.
I did notice that when we spoke faster, or when the others were speaking faster, we tended to go into more of a visual mode. What I understand at this point is being a visual mode, that the eyes would be more up, and the slowest tempo would be more kinesthetic. People tend to look down and feel more. I thought it was very, very useful, just because you're learning a range of speed and practicing that so that you're able to match. You may not want to do it that extremely, but I thought it was a really good exercise.
Yeah, and so these are exercises to help you not only experiment and discover, like we were saying on the first day with NLP, we want to know if you do it, does it make a difference? What changes? What difference does it make? And does that difference make a difference in a useful way? Or does it change in some unuseful way? And so you get to start making those distinctions and noticing that there's a range where it's going to be helpful, it's going to be useful. But if it goes too far one way or the other, then it may not be useful in that context. Same thing with concepts. You know, we're going to offer, you know, I don't know how many concepts in the course of this training. And so for some people, their mind might go to this place of, oh, this is where it certainly wouldn't work. So they immediately go to a place where it wouldn't apply here. And that's important to notice. You know, it's important to notice where it wouldn't apply, but also pay attention to where it could be useful, where it could apply. And then you start to develop the wisdom of where is that threshold when something shifts from resource to limitation? Where is that threshold of resource to limitation? In shamanism, we say, when does it change from medicine to toxin? When does it shift from medicine to toxin? And there are thresholds with just about everything where too much of it is not helpful, not enough of it is not helpful. But there's a certain range where it's magnificent, and that's when it's wonderful to have. So if you mirror match too much, it's not helpful, but if you don't do it enough, it's not helpful. But there's a certain amount of it that's just right, and I invite you to find that out, because it may be different from person to person, may be different from context to context. So the question, yeah?
So are you encouraging us to play with that, with anyone we meet? Go slow, go fast, and see what happens?
You could do it that way.
Kind of disruptive to my social relationships.
Sure. You know, I would invite some degree of that where it's useful, right?
Yeah,
so if you do it with certain people in certain contexts, it can be powerful learning, you know? And yet in other contexts, you just want to be aware that you're not going to evoke some other problem.
I guess I'd like to connect that to the pending question that I have since I was looking at this chart, where I understand pacing now. Mm-hmm. It's like many ways to connect to someone else. Now comes the leading part. So when would I try to lead? Of course, I want to put my kid to sleep. I'll try that next time, sure. But in all these other options, when I meet people, and when do I want to try to pace how fast they speak or how they breathe? Why would I do that? Why not just pace and not lead? Because when I'm connected, that's fine, right? So can you give me an idea of how would that be applied?
Oh, sure.
It's
an excellent question. In some context, now if you're in there are many, many contexts of persuasion, for example, persuasion and influence. And it may be a parenting context where you're trying to persuade your children to do something. You know, that it could be their homework, it could be their schoolwork, to just play nicely with each other. So you're trying to move them, trying to lead them in a particular way. It may be a context in a friendship where you want to invite a person to join you on a hike or a camping trip or something like that. And so you want to invite them to go, but maybe they're not sure, they're not congruent about it or some other thing. So you get in rapport, you explore, because you would love to have them come along as long as they want to come along. So you're extending this invitation, and rapport helps you strengthen the invitation. There's so many persuasion contexts in the realm of business, where you're inviting either your team members, you're on a project with a bunch of team members and you're trying to get them to organize in a certain way towards an outcome on the project. That's another context for leading. So there may be, you know, it may be a useful either discussion or contemplation to go, where are the contexts in my life where I would want to positively influence somebody to move in a direction?
I guess I understand that. Knowing that it's called pacing, I worked in sales, and I see what you say. Well, it makes a lot of sense to me. Maybe it's just here, I still don't understand this leading aspect. So that sounds like something else.
Well, here's another.
Oh, is it the same thing? Pacing, leading, I just don't get it.
Sure. Well, let me explain a little differently in terms of thinking of it in terms of leadership. Okay, leadership. When you exhibit one way of thinking about leadership is that you go first. Like if you were leading a group on a hike. And you know the territory ahead. You know, they don't know the territory yet. You've been there, you know the territory, so you're going to lead them on a hike. So you go first. And you go, come on, folks, let me show you. You know, and you invite them to follow you towards some destination. And there's lots of different qualities of leadership. It might be they follow you because they believe in your vision. They might follow you because you have some charisma. They like you. So they support you. And so they want to follow you because you have either a strong vision, some charisma, you have some way of communicating with them that they agree with what you propose, so then they want to follow. So that's another way of thinking of leading, is that you have a vision or something like that, and you're inviting people to follow you in that way. Does that help?
I think you're talking about leading through pacing.
Yes.
That makes sense. Okay, then I understand.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so pacing before leading, obviously.
Oh,
okay. Yeah.
There's no set of tools and methods that are called leading tools that I just don't get. It's leading through pacing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, yeah, once you're pacing, the idea of pacing is then now you have permission, you have rapport, and they're willing to follow you. So that's what we needed to get to, sounds like.
I can give an example of that. If you're in sales, or if you're a coach, or pretty much any of those things, I had a guy who, before I learned NLP, came to my office. I saw a need for something. I tried to sell it to him. He didn't take it. He left. Obviously, it took a while for the information to finally get to him. He calls me up a little bit later. So he comes in, and this is after some training, and I recognize him immediately. He's very kinesthetic. He looks down, he breathes deeply, he talks really slowly. And I remembered I had talked quickly before, because it used to be if somebody showed up in my office for an appointment, I felt like I was using up their time, and I wanted to speak really fast, get them out of there as fast as possible after I sold them something. But this guy was different, so I started slowing down my speech. And so once I could see there was that connection built, then I started picking up. I picked up the tempo of my speech and checked if he was going to follow, and he did. And that's when I knew it was time to sell. Before that, all
so it's a way of checking that there you have rapport. Then
right. Before that, though, we didn't talk about anything. We didn't talk about what he was there to talk about. I was just asking about his family and how everything was going in his job, and I was doing it. I would go, and then I would do it. And I started to notice he started breathing at the same tempo as me, so he started to follow. And then when I started picking up the speed of my speaking, and he did too, and I was like, okay, now it's time to talk about the product, and I make a sale that day.
I also find that paying attention to this is really important when you're speaking to crowds, because you have a variety of different learning styles in the group. So if you're really fast, if you're dealing with visuals, typically they speak a little more fast. They speak faster, and then the kinesthetics, as Damon said, slow down a little bit. So the excellent speakers that I've ever seen, they do this. They pace and they lead with their even just their voice, and it draws everybody in because they're matching different learning styles. It's very powerful.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've mentioned to some in the room about Michael Grinder, who is John Grinder's brother, and he teaches group leadership dynamics and. He has a program on charisma. He's got another one on corporate dogs and cats, which is a fabulous program. But he's so masterful with group dynamics and being able to read a group, to pace and lead a group, and so on. Highly recommend if you want to put that on your, training down the road to attend some of Michael's trainings. Amazing, amazing stuff. If you're doing any kind of presenting in front of a group of people, excellent, excellent training. He teaches 120 separate skills, and you certify on 60 of the 120. So, which one?
Michael
Grinder.
Yeah. I've heard them teaching this to people that work for credit card companies in their customer service department, where people would call irate, and they would just teach them to match their tonality and rate of speech first. Be like, I have this problem, and they'd be like, oh, okay, and how can we handle that with you today, sir? And then it would just, it's just that simple, and it would just be that so effective, and so there's another context.
So Comcast does the opposite, actually.
I can verify that. I can verify that.
Watching him do it. But he used these techniques, these rapport building, but he could do it with a fairly decent sized group.
Yeah. See, I think there's that. To me, these are really elegant ways of communicating with people. You know, for I think of, you know, my example with the kid in the room. This kid had 13 suicide attempts while we had him. 13 suicide attempts. Now, I could have gone in there with my authority, you know, with my black belt or whatever, you know, and forced him into something, you know. What would have that served? Nothing. But this, to me, was an elegant way of getting him, for us to get on the same side, to sit on his bed and have a chat about how he can organize himself in a better way, kind of a thing. And, you know, I think of like parents with their kids. So often parents, instead of, you know, they feel like they need to threaten their children with reward, threaten with punishment or promise reward to get them to change their behavior. And sometimes all they need to do is get down on a knee, you know, get down on the level and engage the child, you know, so they actually capture their attention instead of yelling at them from halfway across the house, you know. That if you actually capture their attention, get down on their level, speak to them in a way they're actually like, you know, paying attention, so much more responsive to that.
Yeah, it's so much more compassionate too. Mm-hmm. You know, when I think about just the young man you were working with, I mean, it just makes me want to cry. Here he had a picture of his cat in his room. He wanted the connection so deeply, right? Yet he had so much that happened to him in his young life. So when we step into that compassionate space, it just really opens the door for so many things.
Yeah. Now there's space for healing to happen, space for learning and empowerment and so on, and we can cooperate. We can get on the same side and we join forces, you know, to work together. Now I can be an adult in his life that's not somebody who's just picking on him and threatening him, but somebody who's an ally that can help him move in a better direction.
After thinking about it, I think another thing I learned from this voice conversation, different levels and speeds, is how I react to different ones. And like the woman that you're talking about in that situation, she had a reaction to this louder, faster voice. And I think when we were talking, I reacted differently to the very slow one. And after thinking about it, I think sometimes I'll speed up a conversation when I need to be slower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so good noticing. You know, this is another layer of noticing how people respond. How do these things affect communication?